Okay, it looks like we have counsel for both sides. Welcome. You are in the Appellate Court of Illinois First District and the First Division thereof. My name is Terry Lav, and I'll be presiding today along with my colleagues, Justice Michael Hyman and Justice Mary Ellen Coghlan. We are here in the case of Barbara Turner versus Concord Nursing. The case number is 2023 number 1-22-1721. And we're basically looking for 15 arguments or so, minutes of arguments from each of you. The appellant should save some time for rebuttal. If we unduly burden you with questions, we'll give you a little bit more time. We're not completely fixated on that. But with that all being said, why don't we proceed? We're familiar with the briefs and the, you know, case law and everything, but we still want to hear from you. Let's hear from the appellant.
Thank you. Good afternoon, and may it please the court. I am Rain Montero, here on behalf of the defendant appellant, Aperion Care, Oak Lawn. This court should reverse the circuit court when it improperly denied Aperion's motion to dismiss and compel arbitration for three reasons. First, the arbitration agreement was supported by adequate consideration. Second, the arbitration agreement was not procedurally nor substantively unconscionable. And third, Mr. Turner did not lack the capacity to enter into the agreement. Turning to my first point.
Let me ask, of those three arguments that you're making, which one would you say is the one that's, you know, I know you think they're all good, but which one would you say is the strongest argument for us to reverse?
Well, Your Honor, the circuit court based its ruling on unconscionability. So I would say that that is where the circuit court got it wrong. And that is my strongest argument. So turning to the unconscionability issue, the circuit court should be reversed because the arbitration agreement was not procedurally nor substantively unconscionable. Beginning with procedural unconscionability, procedural unconscionability occurs when a term is so difficult to find, read, or understand that the plaintiff cannot fairly be said to have been aware he was agreeing to it.
How many pages is the packet?
The packet was about 120 pages, Your Honor.
Okay. I looked at it. I thought it was around 170, not counting the first page, the cover sheet. But even if it's 120, let's take your number. And then there's another three-page writer. And that's a lot of material for somebody as sick as Mr. Turner was to go through, isn't it?
Your Honor, I do understand that the admissions packet can be perceived as lengthy. However,
what do you mean perceived? Isn't it lengthy?
It is lengthy, Your Honor. However, admissions director Ms. Diamond Walton took up to an hour to explain the terms of the agreement to Mr. Turner to ensure that he understood that.
Well, and we're not sure. I mean, we only have her story, but because he's not alive anymore. And this was after he had his leg amputated. And I mean, the man was extremely ill. You have to admit that.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. So, is when I read through the agreement, which takes, you know, an hour may not be enough time to read it and try to understand it. But when I read through it, there were boxes that had already been printed with X's. Is that the way you look at the document? The X's are identical. I mean, they're not done by pen. They're done by a machine or a computer or something.
Yes, sir.
And there are actually some questions in the agreement saying about, you know, expenses, his money, if he has money, what bank account and all that. Nothing's filled in except what was typed beforehand. So this was a pre-printed form, everything done, you know, here's where you sign. Aren't we that what we're talking about?
Yes, Your Honor, that's correct. It was a pre-printed agreement. However, as the Illinois Supreme Court has noted, such agreements are a fact of daily life. We sign these agreements when we buy cars, when we enter into agreements with.
They're not. I bought a car. You bought a car. They're not 120 pages long, and they're usually, you know, then there's an arbitration agreement at the end, you know, a rider that's 3 pages long. That doesn't happen in an automobile. I mean, isn't that the reason we have procedural unconscionability? You know, first of all, we have a consumer here, right? So it's not a business, and there's a lot of information there about what he's doing, and you know what is your strongest argument to say it's not procedural due process, not procedurally unconscionable?
Yes, Your Honor, the arbitration agreement itself was 3 pages long and stated in straightforward terms. At the top of the agreement, in large bold letters, it states arbitration agreement rider to the admissions contract, page 1 of 3. The first line states in bold, what is arbitration? And goes on to explain that arbitration is an alternative means of resolving a dispute in place of court litigation. And the agreement further explains what does binding arbitration mean, and explains that binding arbitration means that both parties must comply with the arbitration decision, and that decision cannot be appealed. The provisions of the agreement are set forth in short numbered paragraphs on pages 1 and 2. And in paragraph 2,
it says that, I believe is in bold, in the severability clause is buried, is this language, not buried, it's in bold. By signing below, you ask that you have reviewed, you have acknowledged that you have reviewed this rider and understand its terms, right? That's in the severability, which is kind of strange, but I also noted, and this is just something that you may want to bring to attention of your client, whoever wrote this didn't know the difference between a possessive ITS and a noun ITS. It says it's IT apostrophe S. That's a possessive. It was meant to be ITS, not it is. It's got it backwards. So in any event, and then it says not in bold, you further indicate a little bit below, I think, you further indicate that you have had the opportunity to have your attorney review it. All of that is right there in the matter of 2 paragraphs. I mean, how can that be? Signed it that very day, we know, even if we accept the testimony of an hour, I mean, he didn't, you're asking him to acknowledge, you further know that you have had the opportunity to have your attorney review it. That's in there.
Yes, Your Honor, that's correct. And
so what's the effect of those things that I just mentioned, do you think? You don't think it has any effect upon procedural unconscionability?
Well, procedural unconscionability is a totality of the circumstances analysis. So it certainly is considered by this court. And it does state in the agreement that he was encouraged to discuss the rider with an attorney. And Ms. Walton testified that she always told residents and encouraged them to discuss it with an attorney. She also testified that she...
Did she testify they ever talked to an attorney?
No, Your Honor. Okay. And after she spent an hour explaining the admissions documents to Mr. Turner, he did not ask any questions about the agreement.
Rather, he was in any condition to ask questions.
Mr. Montero, wasn't Mr. Turner coming from a hospital stay?
That's correct, Your Honor.
He'd just been discharged from the hospital, so he was in the hospital, presumably for pretty significant or serious medical conditions, at least serious enough to be hospitalized. And first thing that happens when he gets back to his home is this 170 odd page contract that he's going over with the woman who works for the nursing home.
Yes, Your Honor, that's correct. He was in and out of the hospital.
I just want to clarify, it was on the very day that he got discharged from the hospital, correct?
That's correct, Your Honor. And, but Mr. Turner did not lack the capacity to sign the agreement here. Under Illinois law, the party seeking to set aside the transaction has the burden of proving incompetency. And persons of mature age are presumed to be competent. Incompetency will not be inferred merely from old age, physical illness, or defective memory. And Ms. Turner has failed to prove Mr. Turner's incompetency. Ms. Walton was with Mr. Turner at the sign at the time that he signed the agreement, and Ms. Walton testified that he was alert, able to speak coherently, and that she had spent about an hour telling Mr. Turner the terms of the agreement. Mr. Turner had no questions, and she further testified that Mr. Turner was capable of signing his name, and he did in fact sign his name, indicating his assent and understanding of the terms under Illinois law. And all that being said, if Ms. Walton was concerned with Mr. Turner's ability to understand the agreement or sign his name, Ms. Walton would have contacted his power of attorney. But that was
Do we know who that is? It's not even, where is that in the agreement? Where does it say about his representative? You know, who to talk to about his medical conditions? There's a whole section there in the agreement about, you know, being able to disclose information. It's all blank. I mean, right? Is that correct?
That's correct, Your Honor.
So apparently they didn't ask him to any information. They didn't ask about his banking. I mean, all these lines where they're to be filled in are all blank, except for an address. You know, even the Xboxes are checked not to get vaccines is already all done. You know, there is nothing that he provided when she went over that agreement, if she did, but she testified she did. Okay, so we'll accept that. There's no information in there whatsoever, even if it's representative, power of attorney.
That's correct.
What would have happened if he had refused to sign the agreement?
If Mr. Turner would have refused to sign the agreement, he would still have been admitted to a Apurion. In the terms of the agreement, it states in paragraph 2 that this is not conditioned upon his admission to Apurion. And Ms. Walton further testified that she always advised residents that this was an optional agreement. So Mr. Turner could have refused to sign the agreement and could have still been admitted to Apurion in those circumstances. And I know that we said 15 minutes for an argument, and I did want to save some time for rebuttal. So
go ahead. We'll give you time.
I think you need to, if we rule against you on procedural unconscionability, you still have substantive unconscionability. So why don't you address that?
Okay. Thank you for the additional time, Your Honor. I just wanted
no problem.
And you are correct. If we were to lose the procedural unconscionability argument, the Illinois Supreme Court has stated that a degree of procedural unconscionability is insufficient to render an agreement unenforceable. So turning to substantive unconscionability concerns the actual terms of the contract and examines the relative fairness of the obligations assumed. An agreement is substantively unconscionable when it is inordinately one-sided in one party's favor. But that's not the case here, as the agreement consisted of mutual promises. This had the mutual promise to arbitrate, the mutual promises to agree on the selection of a neutral arbitrator and venue. And Apeiron agreed to pay up to $3,000 of Mr. Turner's arbitration or mediation costs and out-of-pocket expenses for claims brought by Mr. Turner, regardless of the outcome.
Isn't that a drop in the bucket?
Well, it is more consideration than what has been provided in cases or a case where this court has held the agreement to be unconscionable.
Well, that was $2,000 and this is $3,000. I mean, it's that much of a difference.
Yes, Your Honor, but there was more consideration provided than just this $3,000.
Well, what about the $250,000 limit? What about no attorney fees, no costs? What the $250,000? Now that is a substantial. A case like this is worth a lot more than that. And what limitation is there on the other side? You say everything's mutual. Where the other side, your client could go to court, can't they, and sue for on payment? Or do they have to go to court go to arbitration and everything?
Yes, Your Honor. This was the mutual promise to arbitrate any and all disputes. So it went both ways. And
What limitation was there on the other side? Your side? What limitations on recovery?
Apeiron has the same limitations on recovery that Mr. Turner has.
$250,000?
That's correct, Your Honor.
And anything that they would sue for would be a lot less than $250,000, probably, wouldn't it?
Yes, that's correct, Your Honor. However, this argument was actually addressed in Justice Fomer's dissenting opinion in Carter v. Odin Operating. And that case went to the Illinois Supreme Court, and it was reversed on appeal. And Justice Fomer addressed this very question. And in that case, the damages were limited to $200,000. And Justice Fomer said that using the example of a fire, a resident may burn down the facility and the damages there would far exceed the cap of $200,000. And I recognize that the likelihood of this may not be great, but it is still possible. And as noted, both parties agreed to give up their attorney's fees here. So this agreement was one of mutuality. And further, the circuit court erroneously relied on Bain. The circuit court relied on a single case here, and that case is distinguishable for several reasons. The arbitration agreement in Bain concerned a homeowner and a home remodeling company. And the agreement provided for no statutory attorney's fees or punitive damages. It contained a strict confidentiality clause, and Heirloom had the sole power to choose the arbitral forum. This court found that these facts established unconscionability. And in doing so, this court heavily relied on the fact that the Consumer Fraud Act provides for statutory attorney's fees and punitive damages. But most importantly, the Consumer Fraud Act contains an anti-waiver provision. And here, unlike the Consumer Fraud Act, the Nursing Home Care Act does not contain an anti-waiver provision. In fact, the anti-waiver provision in the Nursing Home Care Act was held to be unconstitutional by the Illinois Supreme Court in Carter, and because the anti-waiver provision was preempted by the Arbitration Act. And the Illinois Supreme Court stated that public policy favors arbitration generally, but the anti-waiver provision asserted a contrary public policy and served as an obstacle to the enforcement of arbitration agreements. And therefore, the Illinois Supreme Court invalidated the provision. And also, unlike the Consumer Fraud Act, the Nursing Home Care Act does not provide for punitive damages. And further, unlike Bain, there is no confidentiality provision here. And this was agreement of mutuality. The parties were to mutually agree on the selection of the arbitrator and the venue. So therefore,
that's minor, really, when you compare it to the $250,000 cap. And there was no negotiations, right?
That's correct, Your Honor. This was an agreement of mutuality. Mr. Turner did not lack the capacity to enter into the agreement, and there was sufficient consideration to uphold the agreement here. As such, we would ask that this court reverse the circuit court's ruling. Thank you.
Okay, let's hear from the appellee.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Your Honors, and may it please the court. Jonathan Young on behalf of Barbara Turner as independent administrator of the estate of Marvin Turner. In this case, the arbitration agreement that Mr. Turner signed in February of 2020 is invalid in multiple ways. As already discussed, arbitration agreements are just like any other contracts, can be invalidated by state law contract defenses. One of those defenses, as we've talked about already here today, is unconscionability. And I guess I can start where counsel started with procedural unconscionability. And we feel, plaintiff feels that this case outlines that the arbitration agreement was procedurally unconscionable. As the Supreme Court has noted, that it doesn't have to be substantively and procedurally. And I believe that's the Kinkle case, is that it just needs to be one. So Mr. Turner, in this case, is a consumer. And as consumers, we are inundated by form contracts. I think I signed one last week when I updated my phone, and that included an arbitration agreement. And while these contracts generally have found to be valid, our Supreme Court has stated that unequal bargaining power and other circumstances surrounding the transactions are to be considered when deciding when to enforce such agreements.
What circumstances do you say provide for procedural unconscionability?
The circumstance in this case outlines it pretty well, is that this Mr. Turner was a infirmed, I won't say elderly, but he was an infirmed, very sick man that was being readmitted to his home that he had lived at for about 4 years from a hospital.
Was that established? I mean, we just heard from counsel that he had a conversation for an hour with the intake person, and she joked with him, as they usually did.
Well, I think it's important. Sorry, Judge.
Okay.
I think it's important to say that she testified that it may have been up to an hour. It was 30 minutes to an hour. So we're looking at a 30-minute difference of when we can say whether or not it was a full hour. In this 120 pages, 123 pages with the arbitration agreement included, Mr. Turner's signature appears in that agreement 19 times on that form boxes from page 1 to 120. So it's 19 times in the form boxes, no other information filled out, where he's just clicking a button, likely on an iPad or some other electronic device, in which that he's signing to go back home, basically is what this is. That's what's happening. There's testimony that he has difficulty speaking, difficulty hearing, difficulty writing, that he has difficulty recognizing his family members at this time, that he doesn't know where he was in the world, based on the testimony that his niece gave, Ms. Turner.
Can I just... counsel, we lost. Did we lose a counsel? Did we lose you?
No, Your Honor. I just turned my camera off.
Oh, please. So we know you're here. Thank you.
Okay.
So the agreement or the contract, the residency contract, was signed 19 times. The 20th signature was on the arbitration agreement. So while Ms. Walton may have testified that she was able to joke around with him, the pre-printed form, which Mr. Turner had no involvement with filling out, even as there is no information that he put into the agreement that he had any hand in drafting, is completely drafted by the facility. And so there is a disparity in bargaining power as it's handed to him as he's being readmitted into the facility from his hospital stay so that he can continue to live there. So I know counsel had talked about whether or not he didn't, or if he didn't sign it, what would have happened. And the arbitration agreement does state that if he didn't sign it, that nothing would be affecting his residency. However, the contract for admission, I believe, is different. is that he would need to sign the admissions paperwork and the admissions and packet in order to continue to stay there, which detailed the payments, Medicaid, Medicare, how he was going to be receiving services. And so given all of that, the length of the agreement of itself, the timing of when it was signed, the amount of times that it was signed, the fact that it has pre-printed boxes that he just clicked through and signed 19 times or 20 times, that shows that this was a procedural, unconscionable contract.
You said he clicked through? Do we know
whether or not he was able to sign it with his hand is not under investigation. It's kind of distinguished. We don't know if he actually signed it or if it was a DocuSign or if what kind of contract it might have been. What it looks like is a DocuSign where he adopts a signature and he's able to sign with a click of a pen or a button or what it was. But we don't have a specific recollection from Ms. Walton. Obviously, Mr. Turner's not here to tell us how he signed it.
Well, I reviewed it too. I'm not an expert in handwriting, but it did look like the signature was identical at each of those points.
At each 19 times, he has the exact same signature.
Right. So she didn't testify whether he pushed through it or she did.
Or what the exact explanation was. And from that, we don't know exactly.
You can remember or you didn't ask?
Is that she didn't recall the specifics of how it was presented, of whether or not he signed through it or their belief. She didn't recall the exact technology that was being used at the time in February 2020 when they went and filled those out.
And the date of her deposition?
I believe it would have been in 2022, Your Honor. So it was 2 years after the fact. And so in addition to procedural unconscionability, we also feel that the agreement was substantively unconscionable as it lacks consideration or adequate consideration.
Well, counsel repeated over and over about mutuality. What is your response?
I believe that he's giving up his rights under the Nursing Home Care Act. He's giving up, it's pretty much a cap on damages. Obviously, the Kalusinski versus Alden Poplar Creek case, it involves giving up the statutory rights for attorney's fees. In return, the mutuality or promise to arbitrate in this case is that I can't reasonably think of a scenario in which the non-payment of rent or a scenario where they would sue the resident would ever get to that 250 cap or get 250 in arrears that would bring it to that lawsuit. So really, in essence, is that he's giving up his personal injury claims. That's what the mutuality or mutual agreement to arbitrate is, that you're just abolishing the resident's PI claims where then they'll arbitrate non-payment of rent. Basically. And so there's an outlier or a scenario where we heard about if the building burned down. Admittedly, yes, that could be a scenario in which there would be $250,000 in damages. But other than that extreme scenario and unlikely scenario, I can't see a scenario where that would happen. As far as bargain for mutuality, he had no hand in writing the agreement. He had a power of attorney for healthcare and property at the time that was not consulted, that he relied on to be able to be his voice in these scenarios. The benefit of the agreement is the facility would agree to pay up to $3,000 of the costs, as discussed in that Kalusinski case. If the case is given to arbitration, it's likely that that amount, cost and fees, is gone quickly, if not almost immediately, and it really has no promise that it would ever be spent on the other end. So following the reasoning in Kalusinski, plaintiff would ask the court to find that the arbitration agreement is invalid based on the fact that it waives the Nursing Home Care Act recovery of attorney's fees, limiting damages without adequate consideration from the other side.
Okay.
Yep.
Go ahead. Wrap it up.
So Mr. Turner had lacked the capacity to enter the agreement. Judge O'Malley was correct in stating she did not need to have an evidentiary hearing based on the competency of Mr. Turner because the agreement, she found the agreement to be procedural and substantively unconscionable, and that's what we feel that this court should affirm in this case.
Okay, let's hear a brief rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. So, plaintiff's counsel heavily relies on Kalasinski, but Kalasinski is distinguishable for several reasons. In Kalasinski, the agreement required any claims brought by the plaintiff to be resolved through mediation or arbitration, but allowed the nursing home to litigate claims against plaintiff in court. And no explanation was given to the plaintiff in Kalasinski. Only the defendants had the right to choose the mediator or arbitrator. And here it's different because, again, this is the mutual promise to arbitrate all claims, which in itself is sufficient consideration to uphold the agreement. And the arbitrator and venue was to be mutually agreed to by the parties, and the terms of the agreement were explained to Mr. Turner. And I also want to address what counsel said. He said that this was 30 minutes to an hour, and that actually misrepresents the testimony, because although Ms. Walton testified that she usually took 30 minutes to an hour to explain agreements to residents, she specifically testified that in this case, it was, quote, probably around the hour mark. So we are talking about an hour here. And
but she couldn't remember how the agreement got signed, the procedure, who typed it, typed it into it, how she presented it to him, but she could only remember the time. That's right.
Well, Your Honor, I was I'm glad that you brought that up, because I do not agree with plaintiff's counsel and how he represented the testimony there either with Ms. Walton's testimony, because Ms. Walton testified that Mr. Turner would have had to write his signature and that this was not a DocuSign. And she testified,
wrote it. She said he wrote it 20 times identically.
She did not testify that specifically, Your Honor, but she did say that this required the physical act of signing the agreement. And
I don't understand. What does that mean? One time he had a sign and then they could reuse his signature? Is that what she's meant? Because the signatures are, I'm not an expert, but they look identical. Absolutely identical.
Yes, Your Honor. And I am not an expert either, but Ms. Walton did say that this was not a DocuSign.
Which means it could have been something else besides DocuSign.
Well, yes, that's correct.
Maybe not DocuSign, but some other similar type of app.
Correct? Yeah. Okay. Yes. But also, plaintiff's counsel is speaking in general terms regarding Mr. Turner's capacity. He has offered no evidence of Mr. Turner's capacity at the time that he signed the agreement, which is the relevant inquiry here. Ms. Walton was with Mr. Turner at the time that he signed the agreement, and she said that he was alert and able to speak coherently. They joked around before he signed this agreement, and she spent an hour explaining it to him. He did not have any questions, and he did in fact sign the agreement. And also addressing the power of attorney, again, nothing in these power of attorney agreements provide that Mr. Turner relinquished his rights to make decisions. He retained the right to make his own decisions under the healthcare power of attorney, so long as he was still able to do so. And I would also point out that power of attorneys are planning devices that are utilized by a number of people. That does nothing to show that someone is incompetent. And to address plaintiff's point regarding illiteracy. Case law is clear that illiteracy is not a defense to contract. If a party to a contract cannot read an instrument, he is under a duty to have it read to him before he signs it. Simply, illiteracy has nothing to do with showing that someone is incompetent. And also, as plaintiff's counsel pointed out, this was not Mr. Turner's, this was presented to him upon his readmission. Mr. Turner was originally admitted to Apeiron in January 5th, 2016. And there is testimony that his original admissions documents were lost when the system switched over from paper to electronic. However, based on the custom and practice, we have a sworn affidavit from Miss Acosta, who is vice president of business development. And she says that as part of the custom and practice, Mr. Turner would have been presented with this agreement upon his admission in January 2016. So this was not Mr. Turner's first time seeing this agreement. And again, Ms. Walton explained this agreement, even though the law does not impose a duty upon her to do so. This agreement is distinguishable from Kalasinski because it is an agreement of mutuality. And this agreement is distinguishable from Bain that concerned an anti-waiver provision. As such—
Okay, I'd ask you to wrap up, please.
Yes. And for the foregoing reasons, the defendant appellant respectfully requests that this court reverse the circuit court's decision. Thank you.
Okay, on behalf of my colleagues, I'd like to thank each of you for your very well done briefs and good arguments here today. We will consider the matter and issue an opinion or an order forthwith. We are adjourned.